Acknowledging the brutal facts of rising coronavirus cases and a death toll well above 2,000, Governor Ducey promised bold new action to get this pandemic under control, except his actions aren't bold. On July 8th, Ducey's executive order called on restaurants to limit capacity to less than 50% occupancy. His June 17th order already called on restaurants to operate on reduced occupancy based on the size of the business. Ducey continues to tell Arizonans it's safer to stay at home, but he's not willing to issue a stay-at-home order. Meantime, the threat to defund schools that refuse to open in August rages on in a state that ranks near last in funding public education.
Our decisions to date have been informed by the superintendents, and I know that they talk regularly with the teachers and the principals and, of course, the parents.
No, it's not safe right now. The numbers continue to rise, and it's not solely about making sure that they are healthy and stay clear of coronavirus, but it's also keeping our family and extended family safe as well.
This, as three Arizona teachers who shared a summer school classroom in Hayden all caught COVID-19. One of them died. And now, hospital ICUs and emergency rooms are at near capacity, and doctors, nurses, and medical staff are at a breaking point. So just how bad is it inside our local hospitals? Let's talk facts and get the answers. Welcome to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. Tucson's Hispanic Voices aims to bring diversity into the conversation, to talk local politics, music, food, art, and culture straight through the eyes of how Hispanics see everyday life in Tucson. I want to welcome today's guest, native Tucsonan and Pima County Supervisor Ramon Valadez. Welcome, Ramon.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Before we get to the nitty-gritty and talk about the surging coronavirus cases, hospital crisis plans that could decide who gets critical care, and the controversy over voting by mail, I want the audience to get to know you a little bit better. What shaped your life as a child growing up in Tucson that drives the motivation behind your decision-making today?
Well, you know what? Like every child, I think that I grew up with, a lot of our initial core values were instilled in us by our mom and dad. I was fortunate to have them both in my life, and they certainly instilled not only a core value of a family, of how important a community is, and of having a life of significance. But they modeled it as well. And so having grown up on the south side, right there close to 6th and Ajo Way, I went to Hollinger Elementary, to Wakefield Junior High School, to Pueblo High School, and then finally University of Arizona. A lot of that core values were set up by my parents and my family. I'm an identical twin. So obviously my identical twin also played a very strong influence in my life as well. And so a lot of that comes from just having grown up in a neighborhood where we all knew each other, where we all looked out for each other, where we all cared for each other, whether or not they were in your classroom or another classroom or a couple years behind you or a couple years ahead of you. It was, our neighborhoods were really just an extension of our own family.
Be honest with me. Has your twin brother sat in for you at a supervisor meeting or any other meeting that you were not able to attend? So you're like, hey, bro, can you sit in for me?
Well, no, there's a couple of other identical twins that did that on a parade, obviously in Texas. But no, my twin brother and I actually we don't look as much alike as we used to, so that would be pretty difficult. So no, the last time that actually happened was actually completely by accident. It was the third grade, and I was waiting outside of the classroom for my brother because they were being held a little after school, and the teacher comes out and says, "Renee, get in your classroom." And I said, "I'm not Renee, I'm Ramon." He looks back, and sure enough, my brother's sitting at his desk.
Nice. All right. Now to get serious and to the nitty-gritty of it all. As you know, the Arizona Department of Health Services has activated what's known as the Crisis Standard of Care Plan to help hospitals increase bed capacity, share resources like ventilators, and bring in additional healthcare workers to fill shortages where needed. Now, hospitals across the state are reporting right now that they're treating the largest number of patients in their emergency and intensive care unit rooms ever. According to the Arizona Department of Health Services, almost all of the state's 1,500 ICU beds are now nearly full. Meanwhile, the number of coronavirus tests are coming back positive at a rate at around or above 25%. That's more than three times the national average. So my question to you, Ramon, how is the county working with local hospitals to address concerns over the number of available ICU beds?
Well, it's not just ICU beds, Steve. It's a much bigger issue than that. Let me try and kind of encapsulate that a little bit, okay? Over the in the middle of the stay-at-home order, what we were seeing is in the range of about 270 to 290 new cases on a weekly basis. Okay. Since that time, when it started to open up, this is what we've seen. It climbed to 519, 791, 1,198, 1,997, 2,288, and right now, because it's taking up to 14 to 21 days to get results, we can't really take the last 2 weeks into consideration because we don't have that number yet. So as you can tell, it's grown quite considerably. Now, people talk about, well, that's because there's more testing being done. Absolutely, there's more testing being done. But what you have to think about is when we first started doing more testing was right after the stay-at-home order, and we were seeing about 5% in that realm, 4 and 5% of the test coming back as positive. Okay. If we look at the amount of tests that was done, for example, on the week of the 6th, June 22nd, it was close to a little over 13,000 tests. 15% of them were coming back positive, as opposed to the 3 and 4% we were seeing during the stay-at-home order. The week after that was also 15% of them being positive. So what we're seeing is not only an increase in the testing, but we're seeing an increase in the percentage of those tests that are coming back positive, which don't necessarily correspond to just an increase in testing. Here's also what we're seeing. Here in Pima County, the age group where we're seeing the greatest amount of cases is between 20 and 44. Typically, 55% of those are women and 45% of those are men. 19% are white non-Hispanic, and 30% are Hispanic or Latino. There's also a large component of unknown at 44%. Okay, so we're looking at that kind of picture. Now, if we look at the deaths that we're seeing, that is an entirely different demographic. I get this from the state website that's only got the state results, but our public health doctors are telling us that our results here in Pima County also mirror the state results. And so what ends up happening is a couple of different things. Remember, the biggest age group that's coming back COVID-19 positive is between 20 and 44, okay? There have been, to date, 2,038 deaths in Arizona. 1,502 of those were over the age of 65. 280 of those were between 55 and 64. 138 of those were from 45 to 54. So as you can tell, that's almost about 90% of them. And obviously in that group that is testing right now at a COVID positive rate higher, the 20 to 44 is only 111 of the deaths. Now, if we look at race and ethnicity, you see the bulk of it at almost 40% being white non-Hispanic, 23% being Latino, and 16% being Native American. And then we switch the male and female, so it's 55% male and 45% female of the deaths that we've seen so far.
Okay. We are still learning a lot about what this virus and the impact it has on different individuals, though.
We are not only learning a lot, we're learning to a great degree that because of differences in physiologies that we all have, as well as comorbidities or other health factors, it may have different effects on even identical twins, let alone people who are not even genetically related. So here's what we're seeing in terms of hospitalizations, which is getting to a lot to your point. These are statewide numbers right now, but we tend to mirror a great deal. 42% of our hospitalizations are 65 and older. 19% 55 to 64, 16% 45 to 54, and 22.4% of the ages 20 to 44. So we're seeing an increase in that age group, but obviously you can statistically correlate that to the fact that they're also the ones that are testing a much higher percentage of positive Okay. And if you look statewide again, the white non-Hispanic is 35% of those that are being hospitalized. Hispanic or Latino, 37%. Native American, 13%. African American, 5%. Asian Pacific, 2%. Other non-Hispanic, 2%. And unknown, 6%. So it's fairly well broken down. We're also seeing an increase in the positive admissions of per day COVID-19, peaking on the 8th at 70 admissions in Pima County. So as you can see, it's certainly in the uptrend. Now, ICU, if you take a look specifically to Pima County, we're usually, depending on the day, anywhere from 22 ICU beds to 41 ICU beds. So on any given day, what we've heard from Dr. Garcia and Dr. Collin has been that we don't want to have an incident here locally that's going to require a group of ICU patients, because right now the capacity is very, very limited.
You are listening to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. We'll continue our conversation with Pima County Supervisor Ramon Valadez. When we come back, we'll address rumors on local hospitals filling up with patients from Mexico. And later on Tucson's Hispanic Voices, the controversy over voting by mail, the facts versus the myths. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. I want you to hear a Facebook post by Greta Gill, a certified nurse at El Rio Community Health Center, so you can get a better understanding of just how dire the coronavirus crisis really is from a frontline worker. Take a listen.
Good morning. My name is Greta Gill. I'm a certified nurse midwife and director of midwifery for El Rio Health in Tucson. As you know, Arizona is experiencing a surge in coronavirus cases, and normally I would be taking care of pregnant women and newborns and delivering babies, but here on this Saturday morning, I am helping my team with COVID testing. Congress, please help support and fund our COVID testing, the care that we need to provide in the community for the pandemic, as well as the everyday healthcare needs of the citizens of our community. Thank you.
Again, that was Greta Gill, a certified nurse who is calling on more federal help. We continue our conversation with Pima County Supervisor Ramon Valadez, who also has a first-hand knowledge of the shortage of medics and hospital beds as coronavirus cases spike in Arizona.
Obviously, this issue has become so politicized. You have so many people who just do not trust the numbers when it comes to the county, the state, or even the federal government releasing numbers as far as the number of hospital beds available, as far as the number of people who are in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera. What do you say to those who say all of this is nothing but a hoax? I mean, you're kind of right there in the know-it-all, and it's kind of a slap in the face to all of the healthcare workers who are risking their lives daily.
We've got a lot of heroes in this community that said, you know, count me in, I'm going to do what I have to do. The truth is that if you take a look at what is going on, Harvard has a global study, and they analyze both on a state level, a county level, and on international level what the moving seven-day average was per 100,000 people of population in all those regions throughout the world and throughout the country. And what they've determined based on that calculation, and remember that actually shifts every day because it's a moving seven-day average, has Arizona as number one in the country, because especially when you compare it to and add that per 100,000 of people of population, you normalize it. So the state doesn't really matter. It's really the rate at which it's growing that matters. And so Arizona was number one in the nation and number two in the world in terms of the growth of COVID-19. You can choose to not accept the fact, but I think at this point we all probably know somebody who has gotten COVID, probably all know somebody who has been hospitalized with COVID, and unfortunately we probably all know somebody who has passed from COVID. In my case, I had a family member in early April who isn't in Arizona but is in a neighboring state who tested COVID-19 positive and had to spend 5 days in the hospital because of it. So it's very, very real, and particularly as the growth and the positive rate of percentage of positive tests coming back is growing so exponentially. I mean, think about this. When we were sheltering in place, we had a positive COVID percentage of those tests that were done at about 3% and 4%. Today, it's 17. It's 17. That means almost one in every five tests is coming back positive, and it's been that percentage has been growing. That percentage is not subject to the amount of tests. That percentage is basically how many of those tests are coming back positive.
Well, as you know, recently, 42 out-of-state healthcare workers were brought in to help increase staffing capacity at Tucson Medical Center. So based on what you know, how much more can our healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, and staff take? I mean, it just seems like they're just so overwhelmed right now.
They are. If you talk to any personnel in the hospital and the medical business, in my spare time, I'm also a CPR instructor.
Yes.
So I have a lot of contact with them as well. There's not a single hospital that isn't bursting at the seams right now with patients. And it's a combination of COVID-19 and other patients as well. They are doing yeoman's work right now. And we all need to be grateful to the not only the healthcare providers, but everyone who works in the hospital, because they're all putting their life and the life of their family at risk for the rest of us as well. We are looking to see what other resources we need, and that was part of the conversation we had with our mayors as well, as some of them have networks that can be helpful in that regard as well. We are trying to make sure that we have those resources. Again, a lot of the original plan that the state had put out in terms of that surge capacity dealt with physical space. But the truth is that in addition to the physical space, you need to be able to staff those beds. And if you look at the staff-to-patient ratio, particularly on a patient in ICU, it's much, much higher than a normal surgical bed as well. The space is just part of the issue. The staffing is the other part of that equation, as well as obviously the equipment. So it's almost a three-pronged approach. We are trying to address it, and like I said, we're working with our regional partners and the mayors and anyone else we can to try and help our healthcare workers. But our hat has to go off to all those, not just healthcare workers, that actually work in hospitals and medical organizations. Because they've actually have been a pillar for this community, and we truly need to be grateful for them.
I want to ask you a question because this is circulating. So here's the question. There are some out there who are beating the drum that people from Mexico are taking hospital beds from Americans, including right here in our community. Have you or any county officials reported any such claims?
You know what? That, to my understanding, that has not been an issue. Obviously, the border itself has been closed to a great degree, and I think to a great. If you listen to some of the discussions in with government officials, the governor of Sonora was actually asking for the border to be closed completely because she didn't want Arizona having people crossing into Sonora and spreading COVID-19. So I think the fear exists both ways, and the truth is, I at this point I have no reason to believe that is a significant worry to have right now. The more significant worry is we need to watch out for each other. Part of what we did a couple of weeks ago at this point was we passed a face mask wearing ordinance. Look, by wearing a face mask, we're not protecting ourselves. We are protecting the people we are around. But if someone is not wearing a face mask, then you're not protecting others. What has always made Tucson just a wonderful place is, and you heard it when I talked about growing up, is that we looked out for each other. We cared for each other. Well, right now is a really good time for that to take place. And the best way we can do that is by wearing masks when we're around each other and can't distance.
As you know, Sahuarita and Marana town mayors immediately came out once the Board of Supervisors voted 3-2 to enact that countywide public health protection resolution. And they said they wouldn't enforce a mask wearing policy. Does the county have jurisdiction to make rules for incorporated towns to force such an issue?
Yes, and this is how. First of all, people need to know that neither the sheriff nor police departments are the entity through which we're enforcing the face masks.
Okay.
So it doesn't require them. We've heard announcements both from the Sheriff's Department and from PDs that they're not enforcing it. Well, that was never, if you read the ordinance, that's not where it's coming from. Look, the attorneys in both of those locations claimed that under state law, ARS, Title 11 and Title 26, we didn't have authority in the municipalities. Under those titles, they are correct. We did this as the public health entity for our region, which is Title 36, which does have jurisdiction in the cities and towns. Here's how. Does the food code, in other words, restaurant inspection, et cetera, have jurisdiction in the town? Of course it does. This is that same title. So either the food code applies in those cities, or this does as well. And this does as well, or neither the food code nor this applies in that city. ARS is very, very clear. They mistakenly or intentionally cited the codes that we didn't use for this particular ordinance.
So from restaurants to bars, let's talk Pima County. Recently investigated 112 complaints at restaurants and bars related to the face mask wearing policy. Health department inspectors visited every bar in Pima County, 168 businesses in total. Of those, 11 were referred to the State Liquor Board for noncompliance. The bars which violated the COVID-19 rules, will the county push for the state to really take away their liquor license for noncompliance?
Absolutely. We actually sent a letter to the governor making that very, very clear. As you recall, he himself has referred a number of businesses to the liquor board and other entities for enforcement. Because, look, whether or not you like it, and you know what? I've been wearing a mask now for a number of months. I dislike it greatly. I hate wearing masks.
Yeah.
And yet you
especially when it's 113 degrees outside.
And yet you always see me wearing a mask.
Correct.
Because it's that important. Look, I'm not keeping myself safe by wearing a mask, but I'm keeping you safe. Let's keep each other safe.
Amen.
Coming up on Tucson's Hispanic Voices, Pima County Supervisor Ramon Valadez on whether schools are ready to reopen and President Trump's threat to defund schools that don't reopen. I'm Steve Nunez. You're listening to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. As we all know, Governor Ducey has delayed the start of school until August 17th. This agenda to reopen schools falls in line with President Trump, who is threatening to cut federal funding to schools that do not reopen. But some parents we talk to say they will not risk their children's lives and will not send them to school.
No, it's not safe right now. The numbers continue to rise, and it's not solely about making sure that they are healthy and stay clear of coronavirus, but it's also keeping our family and extended family safe as well. Our elders are at higher risk, and we want to make sure that they're kept clear of any contact with coronavirus. No one should be able to have that much ability or power over, a decision that needs to be made by us as their parents, that know what's best for them and what's best for our family.
According to a survey done by Parentkind, the vast majority of parents do not want to send their children back to school. Back to our conversation with Pima County Supervisor Ramon Valadez. Ramon, based on what you know, are schools prepared to safely reopen next month?
As an outsider looking in, no. No, and I'll tell you why. If you take a look, if you remember, I don't know how many of your listeners actually remember, Pima County on the COVID-19 website under that particular page has the 9 criteria we originally set out in terms of where we're at, okay? Under the disease data, decreasing cases over 2 consecutive weeks, red. Decreasing COVID-19 related deaths over 14 days, red. Decreasing hospitalizations, red. Lab testing availability and utilization, yellow. Adequate hospital bed capacity to care for two times the current COVID cases, red. Sufficient PPE for emergency responders, yellow. And under public health, timely case investigation, red. That should ramp up as soon as we get the contact tracing in line, which should be very, very shortly. Testing of symptomatic contacts within 48 hours, red. Facility support for patients who can't be discharged home statewide, yellow. Okay. There were certain points where we had a number of these criteria that were in the green during the stay-at-home order. They have all shifted backwards during that time. Now, think about this, okay? The CDC originally had some guidance for schools, but it required, something as simple as on a school bus, there could only be one child to a bench. Well, that would be difficult for them to do financially as well as logistically. They had to be able to separate the kids, particularly during lunchtime. How do you separate a first grader from his friends? You go over and over and over again, and if you really think of the setting, let's assume, and this is just for the sake of discussion, that most kids are possibly not going to be as affected as some adults, okay? And that's an assumption, and we're stretching to go that far. But let's assume that, okay? They can be asymptomatic carriers and are likely to be asymptomatic carriers for a lot of medical reasons, but we don't need to get into that on the show. And if you put, say, 150 to 300 kids together with the accompanying number of adults that are teachers and administrators in school, somebody's going to be carrying, when you put that many people together, somebody's going to already be COVID-19 positive. You've now contained them in a closed environment where they're all touching the same surfaces, where some of them may or may not be wearing masks. The potential for having cluster outbreaks like that is high. And then think about this, particularly on our south side of town and our west side of town, we are going to have families who have intergenerational family members living with them. So in other words, I talked about the morbidity, basically 65 and above. How many of those households are going to have members of their household who are 65 and above? So now you've created a potential cluster outbreak on top of now having that vector or having that contagion end up in a home that has a high-risk household member. I don't think we're ready right now. That's not a decision that this board or that the county health department will have any bearing on, as the schools do take their direction from the state education department, but it's something that I am very, very concerned about.
So should counties have the final say on a case-by-case basis, whether or not a school or schools should stay closed or reopen? I mean, should the state just give control to the counties to figure out what's happening within that area or that cluster of town?
That's a very good question, one that I hadn't really thought about. I would feel more comfortable if the local public health director had that authority, simply because they could make the decision based on the public health interests of those children, the family, and our community. But certainly right now, I don't think that the Department of Education, State Department of Education, has really developed their full criteria yet, and especially in light of the fact that the opening date got pushed back already 2 weeks. I suspect we're going to see a further pushback by the governor, because I don't think the current guidelines on the CDC are financially or logistically possible by most school districts in Tucson. So I would not be surprised to see that being pushed back or frankly, going to at least a partially virtual classroom. And my concern there is a lot of our children in Sunnyside and a lot of TUSD are, I'm not sure, have the technical resources to really be successful in that kind of environment.
You may not be able to say it, but I'll say it. From President Trump to Governor Ducey, everything has been passed down to local officials to make those decisions. And I think this is one of them where they need to continue that trend to make the local officials make the more intelligent, non-political decisions. That's just my opinion. But let me ask you this. What is the teachers union saying? Are they talking to the county to say, no, we're not going back, or there's a lot of teachers that just are not going to step inside of a classroom at this point?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything from them. I do know that the superintendents are in conversations with our public health director, who is Dr. Cullen, and our assistant deputy administrator, Dr. Garcia, Obviously, both have degrees in both medicine and public health. Dr. Cullen being actually a rear admiral in the Public Health Service and deputy surgeon general when she was with the federal government. So that they are in conversations with people much more qualified than either you or I.
Yeah.
So really kind of give them that level of advice. But ultimately, that authority right now, until it's otherwise delegated, belongs with the State Department of Education.
And what do you think the county can do, especially to make sure underprivileged kids are not being left behind and still have access to public education via online?
One of the things that we're working actually, again, with partners. As you know, Pima County actually likes to partner. We're working with the Pima Association of Governments, which is the regional entity, as well as Sunnyside School District, as an example, to work on, and obviously Superintendent Williams, our Superintendent of Schools here in Pima County. We've been working together to really try and, for example, in the Summit area, to bring high-capacity broadband there that can be accessible to the students that live there, as well as working with Sunnyside Foundation to really fund the laptops or the notebooks that's going to take for them to be able to connect. So both the connection and the end resource so that they have at least the infrastructure to be able to get their education. So we funded the Sunnyside Neighborhood Association through some of the CARES money, I think about $200,000 for some of those purposes as well. Again, this is not a one organization show. This is a team, as we've known, the village is coming together to try and help our young people.
Amazing. Great job. Thank you.
I'd like to send my sincere and heartfelt condolences to all families who have lost a loved one to the coronavirus. As we debate whether or not it's safe to send our children back to school next month, let's remember the life of Kimberly Chavez Lopez Bird. She died on June 26 from COVID-19. Kimberly taught first grade in the Hayden-Winkleman Unified School District. She and two other teachers taught a summer school class from the same classroom. All three teachers came down with the virus. Kimberly did not survive. She was only 61. Still to come on Tucson's Hispanic Voices, the controversy over voting by mail versus voting in person. Is there a fraud problem with mailing in your ballot in Pima County? The answer coming up next on Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. A special thanks to our sponsors, HT Metals, the Law Office of Natalie H. Haywood, and music credit to local musician and guitarist Gabriel F. Romo. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm Steve Nunez. My guest today is native Tucsonan Ramon Valadez, a longtime Pima County supervisor since 2003. Our next topic, the controversy over voting by mail. The coronavirus also ignited this battle. President Trump, who votes by mail, now slams voting by mail, claiming rampant fraud. But overall, election experts say election fraud, while it happens, is extremely rare in all instances. Between 2000 to 2012, there were approximately more than 2,000 claims of voter fraud investigated across the country. Here's a little fact-checking for us here in Pima County. Pima County Recorder F. Ann Rodriguez has been overseeing elections since 1993. She's a Republican and is serving her seventh term. I should also mention, Rodriguez was the first ever Hispanic female to be elected to a countywide office in Pima County. Mailing ballots is not new in Arizona. We've been doing it since 1992. Right now, 80% of Pima County residents already vote by mail. At least two people with different party affiliations are present at all times to observe the entire process. So my question to you, Ramon, is how safe, secure, and reliable is it to vote by mail in Pima County?
Well, we all hear concerns at every election, and the moment we ask them to prove it, nobody ever does.
Correct.
And that's the bottom line. It's how shall I put this? I think we live in a time where you can make an accusation without actually ever having any facts, and that's one of them. And that's just the bottom line. When I was in the legislature, and this was 20-odd years ago, we'd hear at every legislative session, oh, yeah, there are people voting that shouldn't be voting. And you'd sit there and try and figure out, okay, how? as well as I know the electoral system, I can't figure out how to pull that off. But it's a bigger question than that. Is vote by mail safe? Yes, it is safe. Because what happens is, remember, when a person actually votes by mail, that ballot doesn't go straight to elections. It actually goes to the recorder's office to be validated, to make sure that the person that is supposed to be voting that ballot is voted that ballot based on the signature on the paperwork with that ballot. Obviously, it then once it's validated by the recorder's office, then that information gets separated from the actual ballot, so that we can maintain obviously the secrecy of the secret ballot. At that point, then it goes to elections. Obviously, we've had a number of claims before where the counting computer this or that. The truth is, the counting computer we worked with our Elections Integrity Commission over the years, and they had many, many wonderful suggestions that have helped make that even more secure. I mean, some people think, well, it's connected to the internet. No, that particular computer isn't even connected to any network, precisely for security reasons. But obviously, you know, I think a lot of people got a large percentage of people who actually think they have to take their ballot to the polling site on election day. What I would recommend, particularly now, where we've got such a high percentage of COVID-19 positive returns on the test, mail it in. Mail it in for two reasons. First of all, it's secure. It's secure. And number two, when you take it to a polling location, remember the process we talked about. It won't get to the recorder's office until that evening. It probably won't have the signature checked until the next day at the earliest. So you've just delayed the counting process by taking it to the polling location instead of just mailing it and having it tabulated. If you remember, a lot of times we hear our first results between 8 and 9 p.m. on
yes.
election night. Well, what that is that's the vote-by-mail ballots. And so the vote-by-mail ballots that have been returned by mail are the first to be counted and released. But if you went and dropped it off at the polling location, you're at least a day away from being part of that.
Okay, and just to clarify, has the Board of Supervisors ever ordered an investigation into claims of voter fraud?
No, we have not ordered it because, frankly, when we asked somebody to prove it, they never do.
You just mentioned it. You served as a state lawmaker starting in 1997. I'm giving you some props on this. And before becoming a supervisor in 2003, how have you seen the evolution of increased voting among Hispanics?
You know, part of that has been a little disappointing to me personally. Obviously, I am the son of two immigrant parents that are naturalized citizens today. I grew up in an area that was predominantly Latino.
Yep.
And so I been involved in the electoral process since approximately when I was 16 years of age, when I was a freshman at the university. And obviously, I'm a little older now. But you see and you understand the power and potential of Latino voting. And we've tried multiple techniques. Mi Familia Vota has done a wonderful job of getting people registered to vote, getting them put on permanent early voting lists. But I think until we as a community realize the importance, look, folks, a lot of us didn't vote the last 4 years ago.
Do you think the recent protests with Black Lives Matter has woken up a lot of the young millennial Latinos to actually turn that protest and marching into a vote where they can have an even bigger say?
You know, I hope so, because if you really look, if you read what happened, okay, and that was, for those of you who don't know, that was Hillary Clinton's book after the election. Over and over again, she had not just a Latino, but a lot of millennials go to her and say, "I'm sorry, I didn't vote." And oftentimes that was their parents telling them that they had to go and apologize to Hillary Clinton. Now, that is what it is. But the truth is that we've gotten people who are willing to be very, very vocal, but that vocal doesn't change things. And let me say that again. To be vocal is part of the process, but that doesn't change things. There's one thing that changes things, and that's voting. And
say that again.
I said, saying words, being vocal, doesn't change things. There's only one thing the changes, and that's voting. Remember, part of the issue there is if you really, you know, look, for people who aren't voting, it's not that they're not voting. They're voting. But they give that vote to somebody else. And that somebody else is now voting for them. And here's why. If you really think about it, okay? You talked about when I was first elected in 1996 and was sworn in 1997. Okay? Mm-hmm. I had a district of 200,000 people. I represent 200,000 people in the legislature. Okay? So I represent 200,000 people. Of that, about 55,000 of those individuals were registered to vote. About 35,000 of those were registered as Democrat, and it was a primary-dominated district, so the primary would decide the election. Do you know how many out of those 200,000 people voted in that election to decide who was represented? 7,500.
Wow.
Of that, and remember, my district was a majority-minority district by DOJ standards, Department of Justice standards, U.S., and of that, 7,500, about 1,200 of them were Latino, that we could identify as Latino. Obviously, we don't know how anybody voted. We only know who voted.
Latinos, all I can say is vote. Just vote. All right, before we wrap up, I personally want to pay respect to our hermano, who I've known since I was a kid, and someone who is also near and dear to your heart, Ramon, someone you call a true hermano, the late Pima County Supervisor Richard Elias. Sadly, Elias died on March 28th. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, a public memorial was not held in his honor at that time. But now, 4 months later, a temporary altar to honor Elias and his life serving Tucson has been set up at the Presidio San Agustin de Tucson Museum downtown. And Ramon, how tough is it going to be to fill his legacy as a supervisor, as a friend, and as a strong Latino Chicano community leader?
You know, Richard and I were friends for a little over 31 years. We worked together as colleagues and as brothers since 2003. I will tell you that I do feel a sense of loss. It was difficult because the afternoon that I heard that he had passed, I was teaching a CPR class when he died of a heart attack, which makes it a little tougher.
Yeah.
Richard had a knack for driving you nuts, and you loved him anyway.
Yeah, I had my run-ins with him as an adult, being a reporter.
I recently, somebody saw the tribute that we have on the first floor here in our admin building in the county for Richard, where I had the proclamation and memorial tribute to Richard placed as well. And I looked at his picture and I wrote, he was and still is my brother. And I feel a sense of loss, but you know what? The funny things about Richard is that he really loved this community. Whether you agree with him or not, he loved this community. He loved the people in it. He loved the place that we live in. And there was not a fight he wouldn't get into to defend and protect it. And on a personal note, one of the wonderful things about Richard and all the travesuras we did together over 31 years, is that not a day goes by, as you can tell from my smile and my voice even,
yeah,
that I don't remember or that I fail to remember just the memories and laughing at some of us. Just the memories are just spectacular. I think he touched the hearts and minds of so many people. And obviously, as part of that memorial tribute, we were very clear that we are going to be dedicating and memorializing Richard in a county facility at an appropriate time as well. So you can look for that. And obviously the family has said that the celebration of life and will happen when it's possible.
Amen to that, and amen to Richard Elias for his great community work and service over the years for his beloved Tucson. Pima County Supervisor Ramon Valdez, I want to thank you for coming on Tucson's Hispanic Voices. As you know, brother, you are always welcome on the show to discuss any issue that builds a better understanding of what drives tough decision-making for the betterment of our entire community. God bless you and your family, brother. Stay safe and healthy.
God bless you and yours. Thank you so much, Steve.
Okay, thank you.
In closing, I want to mention the Pima County Recorder's Office has a way for you to track your mail-in ballot. You can also get a behind-the-scenes look at the process in collecting ballots, verifying signatures, and counting mail-in ballots. Go to www.recorder.pima.gov. There's a video right there on the homepage that'll show you the process. Those who don't feel comfortable mailing in a ballot can always drop it off at a polling site or drop-off location. You should also know, before every election, the Elections Department and Arizona Secretary of State conduct accuracy testing on machines for counting ballots. The public is always invited to attend and witness the results with their own eyes. I want to thank you for listening to Tucson's Hispanic Voices. I'm your host, Steve Nunez. My goal is to give voice to Hispanics and bring diversity into the conversation to talk local politics, music, food, art, and culture through the lens of how Hispanics see everyday life in our community. Tucson's Hispanic Voices, Saturday mornings from 10 to 11, right here on KVOI 1030, The Voice. A special thank you goes out to Gabriel F. Romo, Tucson's very own professional guitarist, for writing, composing, and performing the theme music for Tucson's Hispanic Voices.